And we are back. Thank you so much for being with us this week. And we're going to do a little bit different here, because I know that there's a large contingent of listeners that only listen to the show. Now, I would ask, and advise you, of course, to subscribe to the podcast for a couple reasons. A, you get to hear our full-length interviews, which are always nice. It's so hard to fit things in little snapshots, right? And they're typically, you know, hour, I'd say on average 50 to 75 minutes long. But I'm gonna do like a 10-minute segment today with our head of research, Chase Taylor, to provide kind of an economic update, where we're at in the process, kind of where we see things headed. And almost kind of like a preview, if you will, of the long form conversations we have. And then on the podcast this week, we will have an extended version of that discussion between Chase Taylor and I. And we've done this before and listeners have really liked it. So it's an interview, but with a little bit different twist. We really come into these unscripted, and I think it's valuable because what you're going to listen to is a discussion that Chase and I have that really mirrors the discussions we have on a daily basis. And it's kind of a behind the scenes look of how we're thinking about things as money managers, how we're strategizing, how we're talking. And so, and I really encourage, when we've done this before, I really encourage, you know, Chase, or we've done this with Marcos as well before, to really not even think about the audience, just to have our regular conversation. And I think it's, like I said, we've gotten a great response out of it from the listeners. And I think it's kind of nice to hear things that are, you know, that are unscripted, and you kind of just get a glimpse into, you know, the actual thought process and the framework and, you know, how we're speaking about it internally as opposed to performing on a podcast. So, anyway, without further ado, Chase, thanks for joining us. It still kind of blows my mind we do this, because I'm used to, when you and I do interviews, you're literally on the other side of the country, but you're not. You're in office now.
Yeah, just on the other side of the hall now. So happy to make the commute over.
Yeah, it was a long walk, man. So first of all, you know, one of the reasons, obviously, that you're our head of research is I think that you and I see things typically in a pretty similar light. There are always differences in the minutia and the nuances of things. But, you know, I think you and I are pretty simpatico. Obviously, I'm leaning on a lot of your research to have my opinion. But one of the things that you have been talking about for quite a while, I remember early last year, you were one of those saying, hey, this is going to take longer than possible. I don't see a recession busting out in 2022, like a lot of people were saying. And you also said that you expected the data to start turning, starting to see serious signs of weakening and that stuff, second quarter of this year. Then you were expecting to see job losses and things like that toward the back half of the year, late summerish at the earliest, that kind of stuff. Obviously, we've got to see where things are going. But one of the reasons I wanted to have this 10-minute blurb on the regular show is, you know, and I don't want to speak for you, obviously, but most people, especially in the retail space, they're watching market prices, right? They're watching the market for their cues. And I think that if you're doing that right now, you're not seeing the story, right? You're not data and markets can have wide divergences at time, right? Ironically, and I'm not just saying this because you work with us, but ironically, I really haven't heard anybody, especially with the sequencing and the timing so far, get it as close to accurate as, or close to the way it is, as you have. Where are we at right now in terms of, I know you and I, before we even got on here, we were talking about jobs numbers that came out today. Where are we at in terms of your framework that you've laid out? Because, you know, just so people know, if you haven't listened before, we're very much in the recession camp. We believe it's pretty much unavoidable. We see coincident economic data pointing all that way. Well, some of the coincident data is hot, but where are we at right now, Chase, in your framework? And how have things, I guess, let's start this way. How have things played out exactly the way that you have thought? What hasn't? And where are we at in that process at the moment?
Yeah, so as far as like what has played out the way I would expect it, that is leading data continuing to get worse. Inflation coming down. Those have largely played out as expected, but I think the coincident data has held up. And coincident data, for anyone who doesn't know, that's just kind of like the look out the window, what happened last month kind of data for things like jobs and industrial production, you know, how much money people are making and spending, that kind of stuff. And that it has all weakened some, but nothing as like a true breakdown that signals like, oh, we're probably in a recession now. From that standpoint, all of the forward-looking stuff that tends to lead coincident data by what maybe 3 to 24 months is all awful. So, and as long as all that kind of holds up the way it has for the last 70 years and no guarantees, then we should see coincident data weaken the rest of the year. And we're starting to see some signs of that. It's just not, we just haven't had kind of broke that the dam and seen like a rush of bad data yet. And maybe that's still a few months away. My framework has been, you'd start to see problems in May. They would get a little worse in June. By July, economic data would be pretty bad and you're probably in a recession. I don't think we have outright job losses probably until about July, but I think, you know, you've seen a lot of weakening kind of, if you look deeper than the headline data, and in fact, one of the things you get during inflections in cycles tends to be a lot of revisions from the government on the data from the past few months. And we're starting to see that where they actually revised the fourth quarter's income data significantly by like $150 billion, and it's actually showing negative in the fourth quarter now. They're revised away probably 400 and something thousand jobs from 2022. So it's you're starting to get to that point where it looks like we're weaker than we thought. Wage pressures are really starting to slow down. So I think we're at the turn, essentially. Now, do we hit the recession late summer, or does it go all the way to, you know, Q3, Q4? Not 100% sure. I still think late summer we can start seeing problems, especially as the repayments hit on student loans. I think that is a bigger deal than most folks are kind of paying attention to right now, especially when you already see people under 40 struggling to pay their car loans, things like that, hitting them with another $400 a month, paying back their student loans is not going to be good for consumption or the economy come Q3.
Now, isn't that, and I again, this is why you're ahead of research, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it would seem to me that 25 to 40 demographic, from what I know about economics, I'm going to be more focused on that as it relates to the economy, household formation, right? That's where your growth is going to come from, right? And when I look at that, you bring up, you know, when I look at the factors out there today, right? If you're 25 to 40, you're least likely to own a home with a lot of equity in it, right? You're most likely to be renting, which means you can't afford a house, right? You're most likely to still have student loans that need to be repaid, right? You're most likely to be paying for diapers and baby formula and so many of these things that are so impacted by inflation. Would it be accurate to say that so much of the pressure is focused on that demographic, that 25 to 40 year old, and that really is the growth engine of every economy, isn't it? That demographic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, by the time you're 50, 60 years old, you've pretty much bought all the stuff you're going to buy. You have what you need. You're not doing that whole filling a house up with furniture and appliances and everything that really drives significant economic growth. So, if you hit that piece of the demographic, it becomes a big deal. And just taking on average, $400 a month out of people's pocket in that demographic is just not insignificant. And if you think, oh well, they just won't pay, like that's one of those deals you don't get to just get rid of student debt the way you can most other debts. And they can garnish your wages, they can hold, you know, income tax payments back to you. Like the government can and will get that money. So it's a little bit stickier of a debt problem. And $400 a month, if you take the average, you know, millennial that has whatever, 75 grand or something in student loan debt, and you say, okay, like $400 a month, make it happen after, you know, 3 years of not doing it. So you probably have now optimized your budget for not having to pay it. And if you have to cut that, that's probably going to come out of a lot of discretionary spending. So I think that's kind of why we're starting to already see some shifts in consumer behavior. If you just saw the headlines from the Costco, you know, earnings report, you'd see like, oh, their sales were up. But then you kind of look under the hood, you see the average ticket price was down 3.5%, not up. And they even openly talked about, hey, people are trading beef for things like canned chicken. So Walmart has talked about how they're seeing an influx of people making over $100,000 come shop in their stores. So the people that are actually hurting the most are white collar people in this current downswing, just because, you know, a lot of tech jobs have been the ones, really the only ones laying anyone off, which is just interesting and different from what we're used to. And so people understand recessions are typically driven by manufacturing workers, construction workers, things like that, losing their jobs. Like the service sector usually does fine, even during a recession. Most of the time the service sector's fine. So, you know, if you're kind of just thinking about restaurants, things like that, those can actually just stay good. But if you have interruptions in the kind of the blue collar, like industrial and in manufacturing, construction, that's what leads to recessions. But we could be in a weird scenario where young people and white collar people losing their job alongside of people building, you know, apartment buildings and stuff right now could sort of make this recession a lot worse than people are expecting.
Well, a couple questions about that too. So again, conversations that you and I have had off air, there seems to me, you know, obviously you can set, because it wasn't a bad quarter by Costco by any stretch of the imagination. But when I see the tepid growth, but tepid growth nonetheless, and from Costco, and I see what's going on with Walmart, what it tells me is that Costco and Market are taking market share at a pretty rapid rate. Good for them, right? But that's not a positive for the consumer, is it? I mean, those are discount retailers. People, if sales are up at Costco by 3.5%, or excuse me, if sales are up, and how much were they up overall?
Like 2 or 3%. So okay. Like right around that area.
And their growth rate has slowed rapidly. Prior to COVID, they were clipping along at 11, 12% a year. So even their growth rate has slowed rapidly. But if I see sales up 2 or 3 and ticket prices down 2 or 3, what that tells you is more people are shopping at Costco and spending less.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, which is not a good sign, right? Because it's a discount retailer, right? So that's just sucking out of somebody else's pool. Okay, correct. So
Target had a brutal quarter, and if you know just look at the price of Target versus the price of Walmart, it really tells a story.
I'm going to start referring to what's happened at Target as the new Tuck rule. no further explanation needed on that one. I figure you appreciate that though. Okay, so earnings versus coincident data. Here's the other one that I think is really throwing people off. And I'm not really sure what to make of this. Well, I am, because you and I have discussed it. But it was kind of, you know, because you, one of the things that I know you and I, that you're worried about too, and that we're always we should be careful about if you manage money, is yes, there is what we think is going to happen. But I think at our firm, you and I probably spend more time focusing on how we could be wrong, right? Because if you're right, you're right. You don't have anything to worry about. When I hear all of the strength of the consumer, and then I hear Apple and Amazon and Home Depot and Costco's still doing okay, but like I said, growth rate is way fallen off, price per ticket. AutoZone came out today, or was it Advanced Auto Parts? One of those two.
Yeah, very bad.
When I see these places that are directly facing the consumer, and all of them are singing the same song, lower revenues, lower earnings, margins compressed, labor costs up, all this kind of stuff. And then I flip over and listen to people rave about how strong the coincident data is. There's a mismatch there. If it's as strong as they're saying, how is this not showing up in the consumer stuff, the companies that are most – like, you know, I look at it and I go, if Amazon's down – if Home Depot's down, if Apple's down, we probably need to look a little bit broader than that. And Costco and Walmart are doing well. I'm sorry, that just doesn't paint a positive picture for the consumer, does it?
Yeah, exactly. And to your point, like you go through the earnings calls, and even people that had a decent quarter, they'll talk about, you know, the big ticket items are having a lot of problems. All of a sudden, premium stuff's having a problem. Even on car lots. A lot of the car dealers or auto manufacturers started making, like, you know, really fancy SUVs that cost $100,000. They got rid of their lowest, you know, car that was selling for 20 grand. And then now, because of that, you know, they extrapolated, you know, the euphoria during the post COVID, you know, year when everyone had a bunch of money. But now you look and the people on those car lots are saying, yeah, we can't move these $100,000 SUVs. But people would love to have a $25,000 entry level car, but they don't make it anymore, you know? So just kind of economy wide, you're seeing people sort of downshift when it comes to whether it be brands or the size of their items, things like that, which, you know, on a aggregate scale does not say anything good about the economy. And even looking at retail sales growth, it has really significantly declined, whether you look at, you know, the year over year number or the month over month prints. It's all just like dramatically come back down. And if you adjust it for inflation, it's very ugly and very close to being what we would normally see in a recession. You're one really bad print on retail sales away from looking like you're in a recession, just from that standpoint. Again, whenever you adjust for inflation. So I think that does explain a lot. It's a way you can kind of do bottom up micro analysis to come up with a macro viewpoint.
Okay, now I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, but not really, just because, you know, we don't know. We'll have to see the way this plays out. But when I'm sitting there looking at coincident data that seems to be in stark contrast to what I'm hearing from the actual companies themselves, two-part question. Am I right to look with a more jaundiced eye at the government statistics and trust more the company results? Should it be the other way around? Or I guess kind of a spinoff second question or part of that same line of questioning would be, what when we see conflicts like that, where you're telling me how robust consumer spending is, and all I see all the companies that are facing the consumer getting killed, how do we explain that? What leads me to believe the coincident? There's something wrong with the coincident data. When I said I didn't want to put you on the spot, I didn't want you to have to be immortalized sitting there going, "Oh, the data's flawed," because maybe it turns out that it's not or anything like that. But am I right to sit there and go, okay, I got to doubt one of these data points. I've got to doubt one of them. I'm going to doubt the coincident data. And if so, is it the anomalous nature of this environment that maybe has gotten the coincident data upside down? Like I just don't understand, you know, explain to us the gap, right? The space between those things.
Sure. So, I mean, for the first quarter, earnings were better than Wall Street was expecting. So even though you can dig through a lot of these transcripts, find things, you can see top line sales down. It was still down less than people expected in the first quarter. Now Q2's supposed to be worse than expected because they kind of just pushed it off. But that's part of it. So when it comes to the data, I mean, I don't trust any of it. That's why I compare it, all of it, whether it's from the corporates or the government, to other data to try and triangulate. And you know, I lean on some things where like Bank of America will put out their, no kidding, just hard data from their credit cards and their debit cards. That's kind of like more difficult to mess up with crazy balance or crazy like spreadsheet assumptions like the government will do. So lean on that stuff a little more. But the problem with the government data is it gets revised later and heavily at times. The former Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, made an actually pretty funny joke recently when he talked about how, you know, they would get these crazy, like huge revisions in, and then he'd be like, well, I want to go revise my interest rate decisions then. And I think that's kind of where we're at, where the Fed, unfortunately, they pull a monetary policy lever and then they look out the window to see if it worked, even though it has a 1-2 year lag on it. And right now they're just looking out the window and say it's not working. So they're just going to keep, you know, pulling the lever. And then we're going to get a bunch of data revisions that's going to make it clear that, oh, we just weren't looking out the window the right way. So it's hard to trust that data. As far as the corporates go, and we both know they definitely mess around with accounting enough to at least make it difficult at times. But I use the basic assumption that I'm just going to go ahead and trust the top line numbers. And I just focus on that. I don't really care about bottom line numbers whenever I'm trying to get a macro signal from earnings, because that's where all their crazy math comes in to tell you what their bottom line was. But when they just tell me how much money they made year over year, yeah, I just kind of take that as is probably true.
Or adjusted, well, revenue's down 25, but adjusted earnings are going through the roof.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I literally will not even look at that whenever I look through a transcript, because I don't even want to know what they said their earnings were.
It's so odd to me that you know, and you know, we operate in these markets, so to some degree you have to play the game. But it's so odd to me how everybody just takes those numbers, right? Oh, look at that earnings beat. And you sit there and go, guys, it's adjusted. Look underneath the hood. It just blows me away. I gotta, you know, this is getting more into the anecdotal realm, but you and I have discussed this before. And it's hard to remember. It seems to me, 08, 09 was a long time ago, but it was like markets thought like that then, and then all of a sudden they thought the immediate opposite, right? After Lehman failed, everybody's looking under the hood. Everybody. Is that just laziness? I mean, I know it frustrates the living heck out of you and I because you're sitting there going, wait a second. In real terms, this company lost money. You're buying this one, right? That stock is going up. Looking over here, in real terms, this company made money. You're all selling that company, right? What do you attribute that to? Is it just late cycle thinking? Is it, you know, you and I both got our starts in the industry at similar times. Is it just something I haven't adjusted to? Has it always been like that? It just, in these times, it always shocks me to see that kind of oblivious nature of so many investors.
Yeah. And it, for me, as a macro person that looks at the like bigger data even more than I do like company or like stock specific data, it bothers me even more. Like the revisions I was just talking about. 400,000 jobs and no one cared. That didn't move the market one bit.
And to give people an idea, we're not saying that that's a titan, but 500,000 jobs, that is not an insignificant amount.
No, and $158 billion, I think it was, in income was revised out. That's real money. I mean,
that's a lot of money.
Yeah. So it's stuff like that, you know, and if that would have came out in those prints for like say non-farm payrolls, if those would have all been lower by, you know, the equivalent amount, that would have moved the market and everyone would have a very different view right now. But because it came out in a innocuous data release, you know, that no one's paying attention to, no one really looks at it. No one cares. No one's doing the work. And this is the same with the single stock stuff where, as long as the headlines are doing what they need to do, no one's going to go dig into the work. It's like you watch the movie, The Big Short, whenever, Michael Burry tells the guy, you know, like, well, I read the mortgages and they're bad. And the guy was like, what are you talking about? No one reads the mortgages. Well, Michael Burry did. He actually read them all. And that's why he knew. Most people just aren't, they're not going to dig into the data well enough to really know.
Yeah. Which has always shocked me because you and I both know that's where the gold is hidden. And that's also where the nasties are hidden, right? Is popping that hood and, you know, getting your hands dirty. What about the other thing that I think is interesting is that, and you can speak to this, this question I wanted to ask you anyway, what are we seeing globally? I know we got, you know, surprisingly weakness out of China. From what I hear, Germany just entered recession. When I'm looking at the United States, again, I'm seeing what feels like a lot of conflicting cross currents, meaning everybody keeps talking about the strength of the U.S. What are we at now? 40% of revenue from the S&P 500 comes from overseas right now. It's right around there. If it's not 40% of the number, it's right there. I've actually seen estimates between 35 and 45, depending on how they calculate that. So are we – I mean, the other thing is recession here, recession. If the rest of the world is going into a recession, we're not going to buck that trend, are we?
No. And typically what you have globally is one of the major three power centers kind of at least doing okay so that you don't have all three doing poorly. So right now – the U.S. is slowing, China is slowing, and Europe is slowing, which is not something we're used to and is very bad. That's why you see, you know, things like oil and copper having a very tough time, or just commodities in general. Can't really catch a bid for the last month. And really, that's just when you have all three of those not growing, you have, or at least, you know, slowing down, you have a big, big problem. And clearly, we're not about to get stimulus from the U.S. or from Europe. And maybe you get a little bit from China, but They've made it very clear they're not going to go back to the old way of pumping money in and doing like large scale stimulus. So it's kind of tough. And yeah, when you think about the U.S. and how much of the revenue comes from overseas, and I think you actually even see that in the price. You see, you know, small caps are struggling. You see equal weighted, you know, the median S&P 500 stock has not really done anything this year. You just basically have an AI euphoria, and I mean, I'm guessing the AI stocks don't get 40% of their revenue from overseas. So who cares that, you know, the world is slowing down if, you know, you just came up with a cool new mousetrap.
Yeah, you just sell everything and just buy NVIDIA, right?
There you go.
Yeah, which is what we're going to do. No, I'm just kidding. I you can joke like that, and then I'll probably just get like 400 phone calls just ringing our phones off the hook. okay, so on the you know, stepping back, taking that little bit bigger view, where are we at in terms of, you know, how we address this in terms of policy? I'm having a bit of a tough time wrapping my head around China. I'm not really understanding when I'm seeing the growth issues coming out of China. Why aren't they just dumping money into it like they've been over the last 15 years? Right. I mean, we've seen weak Chinese economic data. It never felt like it lasted very long because the CCP would intervene and just make it rain, flood the system with paper. What's happening there?
So they haven't done that much since Xi took over. I think he sees it differently, but really a big part of it is just debt. Like their debt problem got so big, so pervasive that they can't really, it's just pushing on a string to do more. And they kind of reached their limit, no kidding, on debt. And it's not really because that at the national government level, it's the like kind of local and provincial governments that are completely debt saturated. And even using, you know, genuine austerity, like slashing government services and spending, you know, out in the far flung provinces where no one's going to report on it. And that is like really keeping growth down. And then they took the sacred cow of real estate investing and they messed with that in the last year. So the animal spirits of investors and entrepreneurs and households are very much damaged by that because that was kind of where everyone saved their money in their society. So if you don't feel like there's any point in starting a new business because the government's going to have their thumb on you, or you don't feel like there's any point in investing because stocks aren't going up, there's no point in buying a house because the government won't let the price go up on that much anymore, you just kind of get into like a weird malaise and a funk. So that's kind of where they're at. Like their exports is really all they rely on, which is great when global growth is booming and whenever US demand is high, because we're still their biggest export market by far. And that, going back to our economy probably isn't doing that great. I mean, Chinese exports have fallen off a cliff, so that kind of tells you that the U.S. economy is not doing that great. They're having concerns about what to do with all the empty container ships and, you know, the actual containers that are piling up in China. That tells you trade's not doing great, that U.S. demand's not that strong. So, at the end of the day, they just have too much debt to, like, really do much more of that.
It's one of those weird periods of times where, again, it doesn't guarantee we're wrong, or excuse me, it doesn't guarantee we're right, but it is amazing to see how divergent the narrative is from all of the data we can see, right? Which leads me to my next question, and this is something that you and I have been discussing a lot about, and it's something that I'm very focused on, which is how can we be wrong? Like how, and I don't have any answers. I've spent a lot of time working on this too. Where could we be wrong? Where could maybe the bulls be right? What could we be missing? And I, when I ask that question, you know that I'm not coming at this with a stacked deck, meaning that question is just, it's an honest question. I don't know. I mean, I'm sitting there looking at some of these earnings estimates next year and they are head scratchers to me, meaning I can't sit up and tell you exactly why they're wrong. I just don't know where they're coming from in the first place. I would love to hear your thoughts on that. But also, where could we be wrong? What could we be missing? I know you did an interview on another podcast where you kind of had the bull and bear showdown with a guy whose opinion you very much respect. Mm-hmm. Sharp guy. You know, so maybe some of the stuff he said, where could we be wrong? What worries you when you're looking at the data thinking, you know, maybe we're off, maybe our forecast is wrong?
Sure. I think first and foremost is just government spending. So government running deficits is very good for the private sector, at least, you know, near term. So if the government just keeps running pretty significant deficits, that's money that just ends up back in the economy. The more, you know, if they get more legislation, kind of like Inflation Reduction Act or CHIPS Act, stuff like that through, or that stuff starts to accelerate its timeline, that keeps spending high and that can keep jobs high. And keeping jobs really one of the only reasons the economy just hasn't like broke at all is because jobs have not broken at all. Whenever you see jobless claims start to really jump up, that's when this whole thing's over and you go into recession. Just open and shut case. But if something keeps that from happening, then you can keep muddling through for a while. The other thing I would say, I've really for the last year said I think inflation is gonna go down. It's gonna go down quick, hard. It's done that less than I thought it would a year ago. But I still think we're on track for inflation to. I don't think it's even half the problem the Fed does at the moment. But on the flip side, if I'm too right and inflation really crashes back down, that lets the Fed kind of off the hook and lets them cut rates and. Hey, maybe they can thread the needle and cut rates enough and get everything to back off before, you know, the banking system becomes such a big problem that it itself takes down the economy, things like that. So first and foremost, government spending and government kind of led job growth, I think, is a very direct threat, one that's kind of tough to model out or think about. Now, obviously, with the debt ceiling, we at least sort of slowed down the spending binge a tiny bit. So that does not exactly help that thesis, but that's like the number one thing to me to think about.
Now there's an interesting setup right now that we're watching, obviously, and we've been talking a lot about, but the more and more I look at this debt ceiling, some of the research I've done, and then a lot of it just backed off your research, I'm starting to get the suspicion that this debt ceiling might be the classic buy the rumor, sell the news type deal. And I know, again, you and I are simpatico on that. Kind of walk me through that. What are people missing about this debt ceiling thing?
Yeah, so this is something that more people understand now than a couple of years ago. It's a little more socialized. But whenever you get into like a year out, 6 months out from a debt ceiling showdown, the government essentially dramatically slows down how much debt they are selling into the economy. So what you essentially have is them spending a bunch of money without also paying for it by selling treasuries. So that's where we've been for the last few months, and that's helped stocks go up, which is, you know.
And hold on. So just so people know, the treasury raises money by selling bonds. When they're worried about bumping up against a debt ceiling, a limit on issuing more debt, they slow down debt issuance. Right.
Yep.
And so,
and with that, they basically run down their checking account to nothing. But while they're doing that, it's almost like the equivalent of new money entering the economy instead of it kind of netting out at zero, because they're not also selling those bonds. But whenever they reach the agreement, they have to go back and start selling the bonds again. In fact, they kind of have to do like a giant makeup bond sale, you know, in a few months to kind of catch back up to where they were. And during those times, you tend to see stocks struggle. And for another reason, then a lot of cash is getting put to work to go buy bonds, or it's just kind of like something that kind of cascades all the way through the risk curve. But literally, it's like a more money or less money available to go buy the bonds is like a very simplistic way to view it. That's not true. So that's a big part of it. So already since the debt ceiling kind of agreement happened, you've already seen bond yields fall and stocks fall. So you could already be seeing some of the effects of what's about to happen when, you know, the Treasury has to go out and raise over $1 trillion the rest of the year, probably $700 billion in the next 3 months. So that's a lot of liquidity that gets drained out of markets and keeps a lot of really risk aggressive money from getting put to work in the stock market.
Well, and that's a lie. That's something a lot of people are thinking, or in my opinion, are missing, because. Based on a lot of the work that you do, it's something that we're tracking all the time, right? Liquidity versus market performance. We pull up a chart of liquidity and market performance. I don't think that there's been anything more correlated with market performance over the last 15 years, especially the last 3-4 years, right? I mean, yeah, it's just a liquidity
this
story.
Specifically going back to like September 2020, it's just a very good, you know, chart to kind of really explain what's happened. Now, will it stay that good? No. And more people figure this out, you know, the less it'll work, things like that. And to get super into the weeds, there are ways they can kind of sterilize some of that where it won't be as dramatic. But if I'm the Fed, I kind of want stocks to go down right now to kind of cool things off. So my guess is they're not going to sterilize much of it, and they'll actually allow for this to hurt stocks in the short term.
Yeah. So if we're looking, kind of stepping back a little bit here, looking economy wide, so if we're looking at watching the liquidity, one of the things I'm thinking is it, you have this Pavlovian response again, that's been built up in markets, and I, you can feel the FOMO kicking in with this rally. In my opinion, looking at a lot of the data that you and I are both looking at, I just really get the sense that investors are getting head faked right now, right? That, oh, this is the beginning of a bounce back. Or is this a story about the liquidity that was injected into the market post Silicon Valley Bank?
Yeah, I mean, to me, really, what it has been is liquidity in general, more so from getting ready for the debt ceiling, even than the Silicon Valley Bank thing. But with that too, like the Fed's supposed to be draining almost $100 billion off of their balance sheet, which again is a liquidity drain, just like what we were just talking about. Every month they're supposed to be doing almost $100 billion, and it is about to be June. And year to date, they're flat. So that's, you know, you're supposed to be down about $500 billion, and instead you're down essentially none. So yeah, that has done a lot of work to help stocks. Liquidity in general has, but yeah, like you say, it's a perfect head fake because you have the situation where, and when stocks go up, everyone tells themselves a great story about what it means to for the economy. So because of that, everyone is bullish and thinking the economy is doing better than expected, and maybe we won't go have a recession, things like that. And to me, it really is largely a head fake, unless of course, hey, this AI thing is real and it's getting traction now and it's never looking back, and that's not impossible, but typically not the way things work in those scenarios.
This has prompted me to say something that I didn't think I was ever going to say, which was Janet Yellen was right. Right? Balance sheet reduction would be like watching paint dry. It has indeed been like watching paint dry this year. This balance sheet reduction means no balance sheet reduction, right?
As it turns out.
Well, or the new balance sheet reduction is not adding to the balance sheet.
Yeah, unless something bad happens and we throw $1 trillion at it.
Well, what's a trillion between buddies?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, if you get into a jam, I'll float you a trill, right?
I remember that. You guys all heard that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so I'm the big rich money manager guy, right? I mean, I own this shop, a trillion between guys. One of the podcasts I'm on, he's always joking around. He's like, which of your 9 houses are you in? And I'm sitting there going, buddy, I don't know what you think I do for a living. You've got me on the run. I'm not Druckenmiller. We're not managing a $10 billion hedge fund here. okay. So getting back to broader economy, what are the things, are we still going to be watching, you know, we're waiting for jobs to roll over. Is that the most important thing, or do we really look at that as just a lagging indicator in the sense that that's not, I mean, we say it's a lagging indicator. We're watching it very closely. Is that more of a thing that you're looking at for confirmation? I guess that'd be the way.
Yeah, it's definitely confirmation, and it is a lagging indicator. You'll see the cracks in demand and sales and all that stuff before it hits there. But what I will say is, like, there have been cracks that should have probably led to some jobs already going, but we have this weird situation where you had a Hunger Games for hiring people for 2 years. So people are really afraid to let go. Productivity numbers are terrible right now. And part of that's because people have too many employees. So when you average out output per head, you know, it's not good. That's because you have too many people working for you. And you look at some of these companies that their sales are falling, and some of them significantly, and they're not letting anyone go. Like, it just kind of becomes obvious. Okay, well, people are hoarding labor because they're afraid to compete for it again if things turn back up soon. So there has to be that kind of collective realization that, oh, okay, not only do we have too many people, but it's like hurting our bottom line, and everyone else is going to have to cut people too, so we'll be able to go hire people when we need to next time. So it's kind of held employment up more than I think it probably should have. But so is the construction boom. They're building a lot of apartments in the South right now. Now you look at the forward-looking data, even for that, like permits and starts on, say, apartment buildings in the South, and that's already turned over. So it's just, you just have to make up the lag between those permits and those starts and those completions. Whenever they start completing apartment buildings in the South, you'll see construction employment roll over, which is just a giant indicator for recessions. And really, that's already happened largely outside of the South. You're just kind of waiting for the giant boom in the South to kind of finally peak and start to roll over. And that's probably literally exactly when you'll enter recession, when that happens.
The multifamily topic is interesting to me because we haven't spoken about it on this show. And I'm walking into this blind. I know that you've got a lot more data on this topic than I do. But when I'm looking at the multifamily home whole situation, I'm opening myself up to be completely wrong. You can correct me if I am. It screams bubble to me. It screams bubble to me on a data basis, meaning, there's a shortage of houses. There's not that bad. Like, right. I mean, when you look at the avalanche of supply that's coming online and that has already come online, right? The other thing too, that I can't get around is I cannot tell you how many people I know that are either involved in multifamily or they kind of sneeringly look at you and go, well, I'm invested in multifamily projects. Like, I'm not exposed to your risk and all that. It just reminds me a lot of 08, 09 and the lead up to that. Like, everybody was in real estate and flipping. Now everybody's into multifamily and there's this attitude that multifamily is bulletproof.
Exactly.
And it's not. Right. What is the situation in multifamily? Can this economy soak up this? I just don't know where they're going to get the people to put in all these things.
Sure, it can soak it up, but not at today's prices, not at the rent growth we've had for the last 2 or 3 years, and not at a level that will allow for the building to continue, which is what really matters for the bigger economy. And so much of the current inflation is just derived from what has happened to rents in the last year or two. So a lot of the inflation we see today really is just the rent inflation of a year ago. So a lot of the inflation will go away for no other reason than we are building the most apartments that we've ever been building in history at the moment. And that's despite the fact that if you go back to like this, I think it's 1973, the last time we were anywhere kind of close to this, and it was very close, about the same level for building multifamily. And at that point, population growth was literally double what it is today. So you're building more than you were when population growth was double. And sure, no doubt we didn't build enough houses post 08 because of everything that happened. So that did create, a housing shortage, but it didn't necessarily create a housing shortage everywhere you're piling apartments on top of each other. And I think people lose sight of how kind of like fluid households are, where people move back in with their parents, people grab roommates, like those kinds of things. And the next thing you know, you have way less households or way more households. So I mean, sure, if you wanted every person over 18 to have their own apartment or something, yeah, we don't have enough. But to kind of just meet basic needs or a clearing level in the economy with how many we're building today, we absolutely have enough. There's going to be a glut of apartments coming online over the next 2 years. We had a lot of people move because of COVID. That made it look like apartment demand was higher than it was. And we had a lot of people for all kinds of different reasons during COVID, go from having a roommate to not, things like that. So I think you had a weird false signal and you had rents exploding because of all of this. And everyone, like we always talk about, extrapolated that to mean, there's a giant, rental demand for apartments now that we haven't had for a long time. And probably it was just a one-off because a lot of people had to move or chose to move during the pandemic or because they got, a bunch of stimulus money. So to me, it is a bubble. Maybe not an epic one that's going to take down the whole economy or anything. But whenever those construction jobs do roll over in multifamily because they're not replaced by new projects where rent growth is flat or negative, and the penalty rate is more like 5-6%. You're going to have a lot less building of apartments, and you're going to have lower rents, and none of that's good for the economy.
The commercial real estate is commercial real estate sector, specifically Class A office space. We've talked about that a lot. What's interesting to me is when I start looking at all of these different things, when I look at, because for those of you that don't understand, or you probably understand, you just don't realize you understand. A bank's primary function is to borrow money short term and lend long, right? So meaning, borrow money from the buy U.S. government bonds and lend, you know, so borrow at the 2-year rate or lend out at the 10-year or 30-year rate, you know, whatever. When you've got inverted yield curves like this, you have slowing economies, you have higher interest rates. Everywhere I look, including what's going on in commercial real estate, nothing is good for banks, right? And credit issuance is contracting, but it's not contracting as quick. When I look at the pressures, right, we're just there's nothing positive for banks right now. I'm a bit surprised that the lending is held up as well as it. I mean, it's contracting, right? But I'm just surprised it isn't. What do you attribute that to? Because like I said, I don't want to be over bearish, but I'm just sitting there going higher rates. And everybody's like, well, that's good for banks. No, it's not. Not after they loaded their balance sheet with low interest rate, you know, debt instruments and things of that nature. Especially it's not when in a normal functioning environment, like when an economy is really humming and not humming off of stimulus and a sugar high, and the Fed raises 1% over a year and a half. That is better for banks because, right, they're collecting more money on their reserves, things of that nature. But when I'm looking at this, you know, the regional banks own the vast majority of that paper, that commercial paper. What do you think's keeping lending up at the moment? And am I overstating the challenges the banks are up against? Or I just don't understand why we're not seeing a bigger drop, or is it just starting?
So I do think it's just starting. This is a very complex topic. So typically what you have is the economy roll over and then bank lending runs into problems. And then they tighten their standards. They freak out. They're not going to get paid back on their loans. This time you're having the bank problems before the economy rolls over. So it's a very tall task for credit to kind of blow up before the economy rolls over. So just the fact that credit has kind of moved sideways over the last few months, while the economy is still, you know, we still have, you know, record low unemployment, et cetera. Like that alone is a big deal. That's also why no one cares about it, is because the economy hasn't rolled over and, hey, the stock market's high. But I think what you get is once the economy starts to roll over, you have already bad credit situation that can all of a sudden like really contract. At the same time, like some of this is, you know, some of the worst areas are in commercial real estate, but then you kind of dig deep into like all these small businesses. Their loans, you know, it's like a 20% of the building they own or something like that is actually what's financed. It's not 100% the way we think of so many other things. So some of the credit risk isn't as bad as maybe we think when you look at it from that standpoint.
The bank's credit risk.
Right.
Got it.
So, but at the same time, you know, no one is even thinking about credit risk for the banks right now. It's only liquidity risk. And I think you could argue the bank lending slowdown that we've seen is really just the banks worried about protecting their own balance sheet. It has nothing to do with them even worrying about credit risk, because really we're only seeing that in autos and credit cards at this point. Everything else, all the delinquency rates and everything are pretty much fine. But I definitely obviously think that's about to change. But
okay, so anything that we're – I guess the big thing right now is we want to watch what happens post debt ceiling, right?
Yeah, that's whenever the Treasury starts doing the auctions again and starts selling tons of T-bills, that's when you see some liquidity come out. That's when it gets a little harder for stocks. And then keeping an eye on, obviously, the employment situation and just demand in general in the coming months.
All right, pal. Well, I appreciate you for coming on again. And I have a feeling we're going to do a lot of these over the next 6 months, because there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff. Well, you know, again, we're not 100% sure on our outlook. We never are.
We'll be.
Nope. Been doing this too long to ever be certain. Like our old attitude that certainty, or our old adage, certainty is the hallmark of the charlatan, right? I think the one thing you can bet on is it's going to be interesting, and there's going to be some fireworks.
Absolutely. And to your point about like the certainty there, one of my favorite sayings, I have it up in the office, is three things that were inscribed on the temple of Apollo. And it was, certainty brings ruin, nothing to excess, and know thyself. And those things are all kind of important to me. And that, especially that certainty brings ruin part.
you also, at least from my perspective, just sort of described the inverse of culture today, right? Anyway, all right, pal. Thanks for coming on. And yeah, it's another one of those deals. I just, again, we've had really positive response. Hopefully you guys will get that. Hopefully it's not too esoteric, and you know, we want to make it digestible. But these are the things we're looking at, and just data. You're not going to get a lot of opinion, a lot of, you know, extrapolation from us. Just looking at the numbers, and that's what we'll continue to do, and we'll keep you updated. So you guys have a wonderful weekend. Thank you for joining us. Hope you enjoyed this, and be back next week. And we do. We're going to be back on the regular interview circuit for sure. Not going to tell you who yet. It's going to be a little bit of a surprise, but you're not going to want to miss that. So anyway, have a great week. We'll see you next week. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.